And the committee asked me to be here today to introduce this man. Early in my sobriety, I was over in Dallas, Texas, and I had been sober about 35 minutes. And I got an occasion to go to a meeting, and I heard that I need to go to that meeting because there was a fellow there that had a lot to say, and his name was Albert M. I went to that meeting, and it was quite a deal. I always knew that a guy like Albert was going to be around, you know, and even when before I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to several hundred meetings before I joined, I knew that there was a guy like Albert that was going to stay sober, to be there to talk to people like me. And he's here today, and we've already had our meeting. I picked him up at the airport and had a great time, and I know we're in for a treat. Albert from Dallas.
My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you and conferences like this, and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th, 1973. And for that, I'm forever and eternally grateful. And the reason that I give my sobriety date is that's the way we're taught to do that in Texas. And I know that a lot of you get to Texas rather frequently. I know that Bo and Shirley and a lot of you get there, and I'd like a good report when you get back to Texas that I introduced myself correctly. Thank you very much. I want to thank the committee for the invitation for both Sally and myself to come back to Fort Walton Beach. We have been here before. And we absolutely loved and adored you the first time, and we're still enamored by you, and we're delighted to be back again. I want to thank OC and Carol for picking us up at Pensacola today. He's right. We had a meeting for about an hour. You know, you get two alcoholics and two Al-Anons locked up in a car for an hour, and you can have quite a meeting. And it was wonderful. We had this immense crossover of thought and concern for our fellowship. And, you know, that always it always makes me feel good and encourages my inner feeling when we have a concern for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Because I have heard and I believe, you know, we're not being threatened from the outside. I think we're being threatened from the inside. And some of the things that we discussed and talked about today, we couldn't find in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. So it was nice to be in a car locked up for an hour and talk about the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And didn't restrain any dialogue or conversation from anybody. We had chapters 8 and 9 in there to the wives and to the family afterwards, and not many alcoholics that I know of read those two chapters, but it was nice to discuss them openly in the car today. So, you know, I appreciate the meeting that we've had before the meeting. A couple of years ago, Sally and I were privileged to be at a meeting with an old gal by the name of Geraldine O. Delaney, known to some of her constituents as God. And Geraldine, I think, has been in the program 45, 46 years. And after the meeting, several of the young ones were talking to Geraldine, and they said to Geraldine, "What's the difference between Alcoholics Anonymous today and when you came in 46 years ago?" And she said there was a big difference. When I came in 46 years ago, there were 5 old-timers to every newcomer. And now there's 10 newcomers to every old-timer. And when Mike read today, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. The path is nothing more than a clearing that has been created by the old-timer that has gone before me. And as much as I think the newcomer is the lifeblood of the program, and I really do believe that, I think the old-timer is the heartbeat. And one without the other doesn't have a great deal of value, but when you take the lifeblood and you take the heartbeat and you put it together, you have the ingredients for recovery that I think this is what this is all about for you. And I think the common denominator that we have this weekend is not our sickness. I think the common denominator that all of us have this weekend is our recovery. And one of the things I heard a long time ago was I heard a fellow stand up and said, you know, if I had a prayer for you and if I had a prayer for me, it would be that you have a slow recovery. And I thought about that, and I really liked that. You know, if there were a prayer for you and if there were a prayer for me, it would be that you have a slow recovery, that on a day-to-day basis, you take the principles of the program and strengthen your foundation to work from. You have to understand, sobriety has not altered my thinking all that much. I have to be very careful. I'm still competitive. I'm still tenacious. I'm compulsive. I'm not moderate about anything. I can still get an evening's entertainment out of a dozen cookies. It's a fun thing to watch. You know how many times Sally has bought a dozen cookies, put them in the cart? And I know her thought is to take them home, put them in the jar, and wait for company. But when I see a dozen cookies in the cart, the game begins. I'm kind of curious if I can get home without having one. And when I get home, she sets them up on the counter, and I say to myself, I'll have two. And I begin to circle the house like a hawk, each time going through the kitchen having a cookie and saying to myself, I wonder if I can leave two. God, I've been known to wake up at 3 a.m, sit straight up in bed and go, oh my God, there's a cookie left in the kitchen. And so you understand, I need this meeting. I need it more today than the day I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because AA is not much of a gamble when you don't have anything to lose. And as I stand up here today, some 21 and a half years later, I have a lot to lose. And I have to be very careful of it. In AA Comes of Age, Dr. Tebow says and writes, regardless of our veteran status in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, at any time the disease of alcoholism can return. And normally it's in the form of halitosis. And I don't mind telling you, in my 12th year of sobriety, I went deaf, dumb, and wonderful all at the same time. It must have been wonderful to watch. I mean, Sally must have gone crazy. And I want to tell you how important the old-timer is when we go crazy in sobriety. I had reason to be up in Prince Albert, Canada. There's an old fellow up there by the name of Cease. Cease has been around a long time, over 40 years. And I remember talking to Cease, and I said, Cease, I'm 12 years in the program. God, I'm busy and I'm sponsoring people and I'm going to meetings and I'm talking at conferences and I'm going crazy. I'm making investments that are bad. I'm running with personalities that I shouldn't be with. I just, you know how we are. I was just unloading and Cease all of a sudden stopped me. And he said, Albert, it isn't that you're doing anything wrong. It's that you're not doing some things at all. And I said to Cease, what in the world does that mean? He said, you remember when you got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you were all beat up and torn up and bloody and you got real serious about the program? I said, you bet. He said, our problem in time is we get less serious about the program and we start to get more serious about the personality. And sometimes we get so busy picking up the pieces that we drop the program. And C said to me, he said, I bet you don't read your 24-hour book every day anymore. Boy, he was right. I used to read that little black 24-hour book every day, and I'd squeeze those pages together to see how much sobriety I had. And C said to me, I bet you don't read pages 86 and 87 and 88 anymore. And he was right. I had stopped reading pages 86, 87, and 88. Tells me, you know, on awakening and when I go to bed, how I'm to function during the course of the day, how I'm to think, how I'm to act. And thy will be done, not mine, to take out the fear and the anxiety and the stress. And I had stopped reading pages 86 and 87 anymore. And C said to me, I'll bet you don't pray like you did when you first got here. And boy, he was right. When I first got here, you know, things were not going good at all. And I remember praying at depth, saying, God, please, God, get me out of this one. And I won't do that anymore. And I used to stay on my knees, and we used to really get together with God. And C said to me, I bet you don't meditate like you used to. And he was right. I had the ability, when I first got here, to surrender to wind. I could get real quiet and I could hear. Oh, I could hear the wind go through the trees. I could hear the leaves hit the ground. I could hear the birds sing when I would really get receptive to what was going on. And then C said to me, I'll bet you don't even support your home group the way you did when you first got here. And you know, he just added up the list for me. He was absolutely right. And in my 12th year of sobriety, I had to go back and start doing the things that I did the very first day that I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if you don't protect the thing that's protecting you, I found out you can get in trouble in sobriety. And I have to be very careful of it. Before I go much further, this June the 19th, I will have been married to the same lady for 47 years. And I would like for her to stand. You're going to see her tonight. Sally? She dislikes that I do that, and I guess that's why I do that, so we'll have just a little something to talk about tonight, you know. I was probably addicted to approval a long time before I was ever addicted to alcohol. And I have to be very careful in sobriety. I'm still addicted to your approval. But when you're addicted to approval, I think you become very easy to manipulate. And I think you do things that you don't want to do with people that you don't want to be with and places that you don't want to go. And if I were to look back and write down the progress of my illness, that's the way the page would read. I drank with people that I didn't like to be with. I went places that I didn't want to go. But I was addicted to your approval. I needed your applause. I needed your recognition. I remember when I was in the service, I got into trouble. I got into an AWOL situation because I wanted to be with some people, and I wanted to be accepted, and I wanted to be a part of. It was just that simple. Except I had a problem. They got back to the base on time, and because of my illness, I didn't. But I never saw myself as having an illness. You know, you and I are dealing with a disease powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. And it's such a deceptive disease that by the time it deceives you and by the time you deny it, you can look right at it and say, that's not my problem. I never saw alcohol as my problem. I saw alcohol as my answer. When you're an 18-year-old kid from Iowa and you're on a base with 95,000 other guys going to the South Pacific, you're frightened. And I remember what that alcohol and that drink used to do for me. It would take that fear out of there. It would take that fright out of there. It would let me live in a barracks with 500 other guys that I didn't know. It would let me live with the emotion and the anxiety of, you know, you used to hear it all the time in the service. Boy, you better get all you can today because you may be dead tomorrow. Look at some of those old war movies, and that's kind of the philosophy that everybody had. Man, if you made it back from a mission, the first thing you did was have a drink. And so I thought it was absolutely natural. I got out of the service in the fall of 1946, and I went back to Iowa City, Iowa, which is my home, also the home of the University of Iowa. And I registered that fall to go to school under the GI Bill. And I had a romance in my life. There was a lady that I was engaged to. She talked a little bit about my drinking. What I didn't know is she was also talking to Sally about my drinking. They were friends. And yet in January of 1947, I walked into a little Iowa tavern. And the lady that just stood up a few minutes ago, I saw for the first time. And I remember looking at her and thinking, wow, she is absolutely gorgeous, the most stunning, beautiful thing I'd ever seen. And up here in my alcoholic mind, I thought, God, that should be mine. We don't court anything, we just capture it. We just kind of, you know, that should be mine. The fact that I was engaged to someone else had absolutely no meaning to me at that time. And I remember saying to Bob, the fellow that I was with, do you know who that is? And he said, yeah, that's Sally Sears from Des Moines. And somehow I got her telephone number. And I called her and convinced her that we should go out. And we are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she said yes. 3 weeks later, I got drunk, bought a diamond ring. Fortunately, it's still on her finger. Met her in front of a dormitory, was so drunk I could hardly get the car parked. She came out, got in the front seat of the car. I put the ring on the wrong finger and said, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life? And she's here. She said yes. And we talked about my drinking. The interesting thing was we talked about my drinking, and I promised her that when we were married, I wouldn't drink that way. When we were married, I wouldn't drink that way. When we had children, when we bought the house, when I got the car, when I got the job, I would not drink the way that I drank, and I really meant that promise when I said it. And I knew nothing about the disease of alcoholism. Sally and I got married in June of 1948. And that addiction to approval that I had as an individual, Sally and I just took it on as a couple. We wanted to be accepted by the community. We wanted to be accepted by the neighborhood. We wanted to be accepted by you. And the way we thought to do that was, if we looked like you looked, and if we looked like you thought, we thought you wanted us to look, you would like us. And we'd drive around, we'd look at your houses. One time we saw a red door and a brass kick plate on your house. We went home, painted our door red, and put on a brass kick plate. We drove around another neighborhood, the black shutter had black shutters. They really looked nice. We got black shutters and put them on our house. I see the heads go up and down out in the audience. And we bought shrubbery that looked like your shrubbery, and we put it in front of our house. And the trap that we fell into from the very beginning was we thought if we looked good on the outside, you would think we were okay on the inside. I've always worked for large corporations. I've always been in sales and marketing. We moved around a great deal. Before I tell you that, once Sally and I got married, I didn't know anything about functioning for the well-being of another person. I didn't know anything about loving another person. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. You know, my having a good love affair with Sally doesn't have much to do with Sally. It has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. When my behavior is funny, my love affair is funny. Ironic, I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that love is not looking at each other, it's looking in the same direction. And Sally and I were so busy looking at each other, we couldn't find any direction to go. We found out in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous how to give the other person the dignity to see what they see. You know, if you hold up a magazine between Sally and I and you ask us what we see, she describes the cover, I describe the back. We're both looking at the same magazine. And I used to pound on her and say, "My God, can't you see what I see?" And she'd say, "No." I said, "How is that possible?" And yet you ask me what I see and I describe the back. And one of the things that we've learned to do is give each other the dignity to see what we see and hear what we hear. You know, if we get here with Skid Row of the Soul, and we're cleansed by a spiritual program, then, you know, there should be a portion of spiritual recovery that has something to do with your senses. We talked a little bit about that on the way in today. When I first got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this marvelous old Louisiana man said to me, "You will date your wife every Friday." I said, "My God, Bill, what would I date my wife every Friday for? We've been married for 25 years. He said, "You don't understand. The alcohol has destroyed your senses. And you're going to have to learn how to touch and to see and to feel and to hear all over again." And I want to tell you, that has come to pass. Sally and I still date every Friday, and the reason that we do is that we're still learning how not to be afraid of each other. We're still in the spiritual recovery of senses. I've known Sally since she was 19 years old. There is a lot of scar tissue there. And yet there are times when I swing around and I look at her, she's never been prettier. Gosh, she just, her beauty absolutely blows me away. And what happens is, I'm beginning to see the inside and the outside in one whole person. The sense of sight has become back to me spiritually. I'm beginning to see things in a different light with understanding. I'm beginning to see with understanding. I'm beginning to see with feeling. My touch of senses come back. There are times when I embrace Sally and hold her as if we've never held before, and I go, "Wow, when did that happen?" I can hear her talk. I can see her. I can feel her. And I want to tell you, you know, I'm very careful where I express this openly because I know you understand what I'm saying. I'll guarantee you come Monday I'm not going to go to the office and say, "Hey, let me tell you how I feel about Sally." Because nobody would understand that except you. You understand when I say to you the pain of Skid Row of my soul. You've been there. If I say to you, hey, I'm dying while I'm living, alcoholics know what that means. If I say to you, there's 12 psychological principles that are spiritual in nature, that if I put them into my life, I can see and hear and feel and touch all over again. I can say that to you because you know what I'm talking about. Society almost destroyed us. I was transferred to New York one time, a very powerful promotion, to be part of an executive management team to introduce a new product for a company called Owens Corning Fiberglass. And I remember when I came home and I told Sally about the promotion. And we were excited to go to New York. And let me tell you why we were so excited. It wasn't because of the increase in pay. It wasn't because of the fact we were going to leave Kansas City and go to New York. What we said to each other is, we've got a chance to start over again. Any of you ever say that when you made a move? How we got a chance to start over again. This time they're not going to know. And the incredible thing about it was we never saw the disease of alcoholism. Sally and I were always looking for a thing that would make it different this time. And you know what we would say? If we had a larger house, if we had another bedroom, if we had a larger yard, if we could get next to the school, close to the church, it would be different this time. That's what Sally and I looked for, was that one single tangible ingredient that would make it different this time. And it was always the same because the disease of alcohol followed us. My sarcasm followed us. My thinking followed us. When we got to New York, I went to my offices at 56th and 5th in the Glass Building. If you know anything about New York, that's a very nice uptown part of New York. And Sally took the four children, went up to Westport, Connecticut, and found a home that had been built in a sea cap by a sea captain in 1812. It was a lovely old home. And if you had stopped Sally, or if you had stopped me and said, how are things going in your life? I'd have said, terrific. This beautiful wife, four lovely children, this home in Connecticut, this great job. And yet I was dying while I was living. That hole just kept getting bigger and bigger, and no matter what I put in there, it didn't take away the feeling of dying or bleeding. I used to commute into the city on the New Haven, and in the evenings I would come home. And by and large, I would fall off the bar car. And when I would come through the back door, Sally would begin to talk to me about my condition. And God, I hated it when Sally would begin to approach me about my condition. And so I would go into my alcoholic routine, which was one-line sarcasm. I loved one-line sarcasm because I could sting you with it. I could tear the flesh, didn't create any black and blue marks, didn't draw any blood. And the thing I loved about sarcasm was I could deny it. And more than that, Sally always reacted the same way. And on this particular night, Sally was talking to me about my drinking, and I went right into my routine. I let her have that one-line sarcasm. And you could just see her shoulders brace, and she would almost back up, and she invariably said the same thing, and she would always say to me, do you mean that? Do I mean what? What you just said. What did I just say? Well, you know what you said. No, I don't. Tell me what you think you thought you heard. And then she would tell me what she thought she heard, and I could really go into the routine. I said, oh, God, you took that all wrong. I did not say it like that. I did not use that tone of voice. And if I could get her to talk to me long enough, she invariably would say to me, Albert, I'm really sorry for misunderstanding. And the insanity that we talk about in step two is we didn't do that once in a while. We did that week after week, year after year, month after month. I've been traveling in Texas, and I'd been gone for several weeks, and I had flown back to New York and came into Kennedy and leased a car and driven up to Connecticut. And when I came through the back door that evening, there was a different Sally, and she wasn't talking to me about my drinking. This particular night, she said, I would rather be dead than live the way we're living. And I didn't have any sarcasm for that. I had not heard that before. And I remember I tried to get my arms around Sally, and she'd have no part of it. And I said, let's get some sleep. It'll look better in the morning. And on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, the only lady that I have ever loved and adored said, I would rather be dead than live the way we're living. And she took a razor blade from the top of the dresser that morning, and she was headed for the master bath, and she was talking about killing herself and slicing her wrist. And I'm yelling, like, God, Sally, please don't slice your wrist. Don't kill yourself. If my drinking bothers you that much, I won't drink anymore. And those four children that I talked about were standing right behind me as I'm yelling at their mother, please don't slice your wrist. And I've already told you I'm a very tangible alcoholic. If I don't see black and blue marks or blood, I figure I haven't hurt you. It never dawned on me that I could steal your peace of mind. And I don't know how many times those children had to get up and go to school on a Monday morning after hearing their father call their mother names that nobody should talk about, nobody should say. When I had an opportunity to make amends to the four children, almost to the letter, they said, hey, Dad, it wasn't the shoving and the shouting and the pushing and that kind of stuff. You stole my peace of mind. I got my arms around that Sally that morning, and we took her to a psychiatrist. We always took her to a psychiatrist. We took her to five psychiatrists. And I don't know how alcoholics do that, but somehow we can convince you, if you look us straight in the eye, that if we can get you fixed, we won't drink so much. That's the way it was with Sally. And a very well-meaning doctor at the Silver Hill Foundation in New Canaan, Connecticut, said, the thing that's wrong with you guys, your Iowa kids, and you're transplanted back here in New England, it isn't working out, you need to go back home. And you need to get surrounded by family and stop traveling and get acquainted with your children. And I remember his exact words to me was, this thing will go away. Did not call it alcoholism. He said, this thing, whatever that thing is, will go away. And we wrote it down on paper, just like you'd drop a blueprint for a house. And we loaded up all the four kids, and the dog, and the cat, and the goldfish, and Sally and myself, and we went back to Iowa. Now, I want to tell you something. Sally and I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we knew about Al-Anon. Her father came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1952, and he had over 25 years of continuous sobriety before he passed away some 15, 16 years ago. And I said to Dad, Dad, my God, why didn't you talk to me about my drinking? I took all the things that you loved the most in this life away from you. You never said anything to me. I took your daughter, and I took your love, and I took your money, and I took your booze. Not once did you say anything to me. And I remember he looked at me almost in a calm, quiet manner, and he said, you would have resented it so much coming from me that it would have ruined the opportunity for the right person to reach you. And God made us all different, so we'll need each other. If he made us all the same, one of us wouldn't be necessary. And he said, more than that, God has gifted each one of us with the ability to touch one other human being that nobody else can touch. And I'm willing to bet that everybody is sitting here this afternoon because at the right time, the right person had the ability to reach in, grab you by the heart and say, I've got a way out. You don't have to hurt anymore if you don't want to hurt anymore. Don't you know for 25 years, Sally took her best shot? And she had some other people take their best shot. And one morning in a halfway house in Shreveport, Louisiana, a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor that I'd never seen before in my life said to me, you don't have to hurt anymore if you don't want to hurt anymore. I haven't had a drink since. You and I are sitting in what I think will go down as the miracle of the century. Ours is literally a heritage of healing which has changed the face of the earth. From two people, we're now 90,000 registered groups in 119 countries, selling over 8,000 big books a day in 42 languages. You and I are part of what will go down as the miracle of the century, as far as I'm concerned. And I get very blasé about it sometimes. That's why we expressed a concern today. I've had three heart attacks and a triple bypass. So I visit the cardiologist rather frequently. And he'll say to me on almost every occasion, you know, Albert, you see more lives saved than I do, and I'm in the business. And, you know, I have to think about that once in a while. It's really true. It's in the pages of the 164. It says, don't miss it. Don't see that transformation. Don't miss that transformation of somebody that comes in here all beat up and torn up, and all of a sudden their eyes get clear and this beautiful person is there. We got back to Iowa, and I was a periodic drunk. And I don't know how periodic drunks work. I just have no explanation why. I never have. You know, I could go 3, 4, 5, 6 months and put everything back together where it should be. And then I would get dressed about like I am now. I'd go to work and I'd go to lunch and I'd have a couple of martinis and somebody'd say, let's go to Chicago. And I'd say, sounds good to me. 3, 4, 5 days later, people would come get you, throw a net over, bring you home. And they would always say, why did you do that? And you could give them a lot of dialogue, but you could never answer the question. And if you do that too often, funny people gather in your living room. And I did it one too many times. An attorney, a very, very good friend of the family's, got me home for the last time. And as you come through the front door, there's no question about why they're there. I mean, and you just kind of stand there stark naked going, yep, that's right. And they said, you need to go to the Alcohol and Psychiatric Clinic at the University of Iowa. And you're going, okay. And on a Monday morning, I'm at the Alcohol and Psychiatric Clinic at the University of Iowa. The psychiatrist that Sally and I had known socially is talking to me. And he's saying, Albert, when you drink anymore, you hurt people. That's right, Don. When you drink anymore, you get in a lot of trouble. And I said, that's true, too. And he said, there are people that are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. He said, your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain. And I remember looking at John saying, I'm allergic to alcohol. He said, basically, that's right. But he said, let me tell you what you have to do. You need to talk to someone from Alcoholics Anonymous, and you need to go to an AA meeting. There was a fellow by the name of Gil Voss that I met through our attorney. He's dead now. And Gil did exactly what it tells you to do, working with others in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took a Friday afternoon, a very busy Friday afternoon, that he didn't have. And I remember how he talked to me. You know, he didn't talk down to me. He didn't talk around me. He didn't talk about me at all. What he talked about was himself and the guilt and the shame and the degradation and the DWIs and the bankruptcies and the divorces and the separate. It was a terrible story. I went home and told Sally, I said, my God, it was a terrible story. If I get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. And in 1967, Sally and I went to our first AA meeting. This man and his wife. And a man stood up much like O.C. said, my name is, and I'm an alcoholic. And I remember my reaction. That was, God, Sally, get me out of here. I am not like them. And they gathered in the living room again, and they said, we're going to take your house. We're going to sell it. We're going to keep the equity. We're going to auction off the furniture. We're going to keep the equity. As I looked down at Sally, and I flashed back to the house is being sold, the furniture is being auctioned, we never saw the disease of alcoholism. She never called me an alcoholic. Kids got to be 18 and they'd go off to school, and I'd think, man, isn't that terrific? Truth of the matter is, once they got out of that alcoholic home, they stayed out of that alcoholic home. My daughter had written me a letter one time saying, you'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same. And I remember reading it over and over again, thinking, what have I done to destroy the relationship with my daughter? And the oldest son hit the campus in the late 60s, and it was a very rebellious time, and he got into drugs and sold and trafficked and jailed and married and divorced with a youngster before he was 20 and another youngster in a relationship with no marriage. And I remember Sally and I trying to sit down in the quietness of our home for a minute and say, what is going on? This is certainly not the values that we wanted for our children. And the middle son just left. It just seemed to me like I came to breakfast one morning and Tom was gone. And John, the youngest son, was just too small. He was just too young. Age would not let him get out of the house. I'd been fired from Owens Corning Fiberglass, but I had an executive friend in Toledo that owed me a favor. And I leveraged him to get a job in Louisiana. And in 1972, Sally and little John and I moved to Shreveport, Louisiana. And I'm sure you will hear Sally talk about that tonight. And it was a year that I don't remember much about. Except one night I was leaving a place called Shreve Square, and I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw these red lights going around, and I thought, whoops! I've heard about Caddo Parish police deputies, and they're mean and they're ornery, and I'll try to be ready for them when they get the car stopped. And Once again, I remember being so drunk I had a tough time getting the car parked. And they came around to the side window, and I rolled the window down, and I remember this Caddo Parish police deputy said, "Could I have your driver's license?" And I said, "You bet." And I just handed it to him out the window. And then I made a mistake. I rolled the window up, drove off, and left them standing there. And I'll tell you, that makes them mad. And the second time they got the car stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. They just kind of pulled me through the window. And I remember going up over the hood and the handcuffs going up the back. And I'm thinking, God, I hope nobody's watching this, you know, cars and people. And they get me down to the jail cell on Texas Avenue there in Shreveport and do all the wonderful things that they do for driving while intoxicated. The guy said, "We're going to put you in a cell." It's terrific. And then one of them said, "You make a call." And when the man said you could make a call, I was just hollow after feeling went through because I didn't have anybody to call. People that had loved me for a long time, don't call. We don't care. And God works in funny and strange ways because I called a man that's not in the program. He was a customer of mine. And I remember Frank came down and got me out of jail. We got in the front seat of his car, and I said to Frank, "Frank, let's go get a six-pack and straighten this out." He said, No. I said, "Why don't you spend the night at my house, and in the morning, we'll try to figure out what to do with you." And when he said, "Try to figure out what to do with me," I mean, this degrading sound of, what do you mean, try to figure out what to do with me? And he had a big bottle of Pepsi-Cola in his refrigerator, and I remember I kind of pulled on that all night long, and I was watching this big kitchen clock, and it got to be 6 o'clock, and I called Father Paul down at Holy Cross Church, and I said, "Father, this is Albert, and I'm in." He said, "Can you get down to the church?" And I said, "Yes, I can." And we began to talk, and he said, "Albert, I want you to go to this halfway house. It's called the Bridge House on Stoner Avenue. There's a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor down there that I think you can relate to." And up here I'm thinking, how in the hell could I relate to a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor in a halfway house? I'm kind of a high-class guy. And on 10:30, at 10:30 that Friday morning, I walked to the Bridge House from the church. And there were three Bills there that morning. They're all dead now. Bill Spell, Bill Steely, and Bill Smith. And they sat me down at the end of the table, and the first guy said to me, "When'd you have your last drink?" And I there was a guy in East Texas said there used to be a little piece, there's a piece of white velvet on the inside of each one of us that even God doesn't permit us to soil, that our time comes. And all I can think is my time came that morning, because when they said to me, "When did you have your last drink?" it just began to pour out. I said, "I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks, and I got this DWI, and the house is gone, and the furniture is gone, and three of the four kids are gone, and Sally's trying to leave, and I'm about to get fired, and they're trying to pick up the car." And I heard one guy lean over there and said, "Boy, sure sounds like one of us." Next guy said, "Would you do anything to get sober?" I said, "I'll do anything." And the next guy said, "Would you go to 7 meetings in a row?" 7 meetings in a row. Man, I swung around and I saw those dippy nickel and dime slogans over my shoulder, and God, you know, they're talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And this wonderful old Louisiana man put his arm around me and said, "Albert, we need to go for a ride." "As you bet, boy." And we, you know, I got in the front seat of his car, and I said, "Where were you?" He said, "We're going over to Shepherd Hospital." He said, "I have a friend in the alcoholic ward, and I want you to meet Sister Jermaine." And I'm thinking, boy, he's just checking me in. I know what he's doing. And on the way to the hospital, he set the hook. And this is how he got me. He said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking." And that's all he said. Didn't say any more, didn't say any less. And I started thinking about that. He never did quit drinking. The priest is right. I can relate to that. I don't know how he's doing that. And I met his friend, and I met Sister Jermaine, and we started back to the halfway house, and he set the hook in me one more time. He said, "You know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. Matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow." And I took the bait. I said, "Bill, how long have you been doing that?" He said, "What's that, Albert?" I said, "That not quit drinking. 27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow." But he said, Albert, you have to understand, nobody ever took my right to drink away from me. And all of a sudden, it was like, I don't know, I'd have given anything to be like him. Just at that moment, because I was loud and he was quiet and I was nervous and he was, everything I was, he wasn't. And I was just fascinated. And my mind became receptive and I heard myself say things like, yes, sir. You'll be at that halfway house at 10:30 every morning. Yes, sir. And you're not going to travel on the road and sell anymore. Yes, sir. What am I going to do? He said, you're going to sell used cars? I said, I've never sold used cars. He said, you're going to start. I said, yes, sir. Following day, I went to a place called Donaldson Dodge, a man that I used to play golf with at the country club. And I said, Mr. Donaldson, I need a job selling used cars. I don't have a job for you there, but you can paint the offices for 2 weeks. And that's what I did the first 2 weeks of my sobriety. I painted the used car offices at Donaldson Dodge in Shreveport, Louisiana. And Bill came to see me every single day. The old timer came to see me every single day. And he'd roll the window down and he'd say, you all right, Albert? And I'd say, I'm fine. And that night, he would take Ruth and Bill would take Sally and I to a meeting. And one day, Bill came by and he said, you know, you have to get a sponsor that you can relate to every single day. And I thought, I don't know. I said to Bill, aren't you my sponsor? He said, I'll always be your sponsor. But he said, you need a sponsor that you can relate to every single day. He said, there's a fellow that travels for RCA on the road, RCA on the road and stays sober. He said, I think he'd be a good sponsor for you. Did you ever notice who we turn our life over to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? On a Thursday night at the Highland Group in Shreveport, Louisiana, I'm looking for a fellow by the name of Hoss Ross. And I said to a couple of the guys, when he comes in, point him out. And through the side door back there, the goofiest looking guy you ever saw. About 6'4", weighed 135 pounds, and he dressed all in one color. All green, all blue, all whatever he was wearing. And I went over to Hoss. I said, you Hoss Ross? He said, that's right, son. I said, you travel on the road for RCA and stay sober? He said, that's right, son. I said, Bill Smith says you'd be a good sponsor for me. Would you be my sponsor? He said, I'd be honored. He said, you have one of those big books? I said, not of my own. He said, you do now. And he bought me one that night. And he wrote in the front of it, to a long life in the fellowship, Hoss Ross and his sobriety day. He said, you belong anywhere? And I said, no, I don't. He said, you do now. I signed a card to the Highland Group that night. And I want to tell you, Hoss called me every single day. Drove me crazy. He'd call and say, what are you doing, son? I said, nothing. He said, I'll be right over. And he was one of those guys that just kind of said, get in the car. No, you'll sit here. No. Here. You know. He called one night. He said, what are you doing? So I said, Hoss, I'm busy tonight. He said, good, I'll do it with you. Didn't make any difference, you know. God. Hoss taught me honesty, and Hoss taught me courage, and Hoss taught me the steps, and Hoss taught me the principles, and Hoss told me things that I thought no man would tell another man. And on December the 13th of 1973, Sally, John, and my little son and myself, little John and myself, we drove to Dallas, Texas, and we didn't know a soul. And I was driving a car that had been co-signed by Hoss. I was going to a job with RCA that had been arranged by Hoss. And the money that Sally and I had to buy groceries that first week was lent to me by Hoss. And sometimes I have to check my values to see if I treat the newcomer the way the old-timer treated me. I get a little upset with myself sometimes. The youngest son disliked our sobriety and our recovery so much that he kept a loaded shotgun in the bedroom for Sally and I. As a matter of fact, he couldn't stay with us. He had to go back to Louisiana and live with the family for 6 months so Sally and I could get started. We found a group called Alpha, and we got very busy in Alpha. Sally got very busy in the Al-Anon family group, and I got very busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's what the old-timers taught Sally and I, is to get busy in the fellowship. And a couple of years went by, and one weekend, Sally and I were looking at a townhouse. We were just killing a weekend. I've always said that's what alcoholics do that don't have any money. We look at houses. We're just trying to kill a weekend. And this lady said to us, it's only $50,000, 5% down, 8.75% interest, 30-year loan. And Sally and I giggled because we had a difficult time cashing a $25 check the day before at a shopping center. And I remember I called Bill that night over in Louisiana, and I was just kind of checking in, and I was telling him, and Bill listened for a while, and he said, "Would you like to buy that house?" And I said, "Well, of course we'd like to buy that house." He said, "You haven't forgotten about honesty yet, have you?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." He said, "Well, why don't you write a letter?" I said, "To whom?" He said, "The loan committee that lady was talking about." He said, "You ever notice how we alcoholics are scared to death of losing something we don't own anyway?" And so Sally and I sat down with the guidance of the old timer and said, "You know, my name is Albert Myers. I'm a member of the Alpha Group, Alcoholics Anonymous, Dallas, Texas. I work for this company. This is my responsibility. This is what I make. Sally works for this group of doctors. She's a very active member of the Al-Anon Family Group, Alpha, Dallas, Texas. This is what she makes." And we wrote it all down in this letter. And on a Monday morning, Sally and I found ourselves in front of a little place called Oak Cliff Savings and Loan, scared to death. And we held hands and did what our sponsor told us to do. And together we said out loud, holding hands, "God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always." And Sally and I had this feeling of whatever happens is going to happen. It's okay. And we weren't frightened, and we were able to go in and sit down in front of a loan officer who got down to money and credit. And I said, "We don't have any money and we don't have any credit." And that brings a strange look to a loan officer's face. Especially when you hand him a letter and say, "Here, give this to the loan committee and let them decide what we should do." And Sally and I filled out the rest of the papers and we left. And it was, I want to say, 4 or 5 weeks they called and said, "Come get your $50,000. And Sally and I are privileged to sponsor quite a few people that say, "You know, I can't get started. I can't get a car. I can't get a credit card. I can't get a house. I can't buy any land. I can't get any boats." You know, and both of us say, "Well, hey, write a letter." They said, "That'll never work." And we say, "Oh, we know, but do it anyway. You know, it's just a matter of time before the phone rings and they'll say, 'You'll never guess, we're on the second phase of getting the house.' I'll be darned." Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Time is getting short, and I don't want to miss the family recovery of this thing because it's been miraculous. Also, I want to tell you about my sponsor that I had in Dallas for 20 years that shot himself for 32 years in the program. The daughter who wrote me the letter 7 or 8 years ago called and said, "Hey, Dad, could I bring the grandson and come to Texas?" And I said, "When are you coming?" And she told me, and I said, "You may want to pick another weekend because the mother's going to be at a woman-to-woman conference up in Oklahoma." And she said, "No, I'd like to come down and be with you." And I'm a father that's plagued with a tremendous amount of guilt where his children are concerned. I've already confessed to you that I'm a very tangible alcoholic. And my amends go a little like this: "Roxy, I'm sorry for the things that I did. I feel badly for the promises that I made and couldn't keep. And God willing, it'll never happen again. And would you like a colored television set?" I mean, I just want you to know that I'm really serious about this amend. And they kind of look at it, you know, they go, "Oh, God, Dad is never going to grow up." So they just kind of put up with me. And she came down, and we were shopping at North Park, one of the malls close to where we live. And I said to Roxy, "I see in this morning's paper that George Shearing and Mel Torme are playing down at Fairmont. How'd you like a night out on the town with your dad?" She said, "I'd love that." We made arrangements for the sitter and got all fancied up and went down to this fussy hotel. And the maitre d' took us to our table and the music began to play. And I said to Roxy, "Would you like to dance?" And as I'm holding my girl and we're dancing, and all of a sudden I hear her say, "You're the greatest dad in all the world. And I love you so much. And you are so special. And you mean so much to me." And I'm going, wow. You know, the tongue is a poor instrument in the affairs of the heart. I couldn't tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous meant to me that night. Now, here I am holding my girl, and she's saying things to me that I would not have known. I just wouldn't have known how to do that on my own. And I have a love affair and a trust with my daughter today that is just special. The oldest son continued to have problems. If you and I cripple our kids in the home with the disease of alcoholism, why should we be startled when they struggle and fall down in society? He continued to get in jail frequently. They called one time from Austin. He was in jail on two counts of criminal mischief, and the bail had been set. The attorney's fees were $2,000, and I'm writing this check for $2,000 to go to the attorney. And up here in my mind, I said to myself, Chuck will know. Chuck can obviously see that this $2,000 is different than co-signing for the car and the furniture and on. He'll know that this is different. And Ellie Allen on in this room can tell you that isn't going to work. But when you're a father that's plagued with a lot of guilt, you try to put every stone in the mosaic that you can to put it back where it was. And I sent the money down, and it was just a matter of time before they called and they said he's back in jail again on criminal harassment. The bail had been set, the attorney's fees had gone up, and Chuck and I were talking. And I don't know how or why I did it. Our conversation just came to an end. And I remember saying to Chuck, Chuck, I really love you, pal, but I'm done. I don't know how you got in. I don't know how you're going to get out, but I'm done. And I put the phone down. Now, I've heard Al-Anons talk about frozen emotions, and I'm sitting there, and I can't even think of anybody to call. And I called an Al-Anon, and I said, I've just said no to my son for the first time in 12 years, and my heart is broken. And she said, of course it is, you're a father, but you've got to work the steps. And I got about half mad. I said, damn it, I know the steps. And she said, yeah, but you ain't working them. And I remember saying to her, well, help me. And she said, well, admit you're powerless over your son. He makes your life unmanageable. And I'm standing there with the phone going, I'm powerless over Chuck. He makes my life unmanageable. I'm powerless over Chuck, and he makes my life unmanageable. And it was like an extra light came on. It was just, that's the way. And a power greater than yourself will restore him to sanity and restore you to sanity. If you turn his will and his life over to the care of God, and you turn your will and your life over to the care of God, you don't have that problem. Now write down several things that make you feel guilty about your son. And I don't mind telling you, Al-Anon took pieces of my heart that morning and put them back together for me. A couple of years went by, and I managed to get close to Chuck, and Chuck got close to me, and we started being father, son, and friend, friend, and golfer to golfer, and a lot of things. A couple of years ago, Sally and I went down to Austin to see the sons over Mother's Day, and on a Monday or on a Sunday morning, Sally and I went by the house, and I remember Chuck giving Sally a big hug and happy Mother's Day. And we went back to Dallas, and that night about 12:30, quarter one, the phone rang. And the lady that Chuck was living with was on the other end of the phone saying, I just want you to know that Chuck has been drunk all day, that he's trashed the house, and there's blood everywhere, and the police have just taken him away. And I wanted to say, are you talking about our Chuck? Our Chuck? And all of a sudden I heard this voice on the other end said, don't you know he's a full-blown alcoholic? And I want to go, no, 20 years in the program, I don't have him pegged. You see, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous where it says working with others, I can do that. God, I can look over here, I can see your kids see untreated alcoholism, and I know exactly what to do with you. My problem is when I swing over here and see my own, I see social misbehavior. I can't get it over there. I cannot get total acceptance without a certain amount of expectations. And Sally and myself, our salvation is, when the time is right, we'll save your kids and you'll save ours. Phone rang at 5:30 the next morning. It was Charlie. I said, Dad, I said, yeah. How you doing? He said, not too good. I said, what can I do for you? He said, I think I need your club. Really? Said, you just stand still. And I called Austin, a couple of the guys. They, you know, we do it. Alcoholics always do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they went and they got him and they picked him up. They took him to the meeting. They got his desire tip. They bought him a big book. And boy, Sally and I are going, yeah, you know, damn, he's in there. You could hear it in his voice. You could see it in his eyes. You could feel it in his manner. And a month went by, and 2 months went by, and we're talking one weekend, and Chuck said to me, God, Dad, the smoke in those meetings really depressed me. Is that right? I don't know what you're going to do about that, Charlie, because the magic's in the meeting. No secret to this thing. The magic is in the meeting. If you don't want the magic, partner, and Sally and I are able to let him go. Appears to be doing fine right now. There's a lady in his life. But Sally and I are comfortable with the fact when the time is right, you'll save Charlie. We're not going to save him. You and God will save Charlie. We're there. The middle son got married 4 years ago, and Sally and I went up to Springfield, Illinois for the wedding. And at the reception, I saw Tom dancing with Sally, and when she came back to the table, his glare and his beam and his smile. And I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Tom just told me that he hopes that he and Karen can have a marriage just like yours and mine." I said, "Wow." Little John, who used to keep the shotgun for us, when he was a senior in high school, they just called and said, "Hey, if he'll just leave, we'll mail it to him. Just get him out of here." You know. He's now 37. He lives in New York and Hong Kong, is president and chief executive officer of his company. John's never been at a meeting, at a conference, but I'll tell you, he knows the program and he understands the principles. And we are programmed for traction. It's nice to have a love affair going with your lady after 47 years. Sally and I still try to date every Friday. We're still learning how not to be afraid of each other. And what we have in our feelings for each other and our protection for each other and our sensitivity for each other, you taught us. I have a little 89-year-old mom that Sally and I brought back to Texas a couple years ago. I've had a love-hate relationship with my mom for a long time. Absolutely adored her when she was in California and I was in Texas. Just loved her no end. And a couple of years ago, my little lady and I, or that time 87-year-old mom, said, "You know, it's really tough for me to go to the grocery store, and I'm having a difficult time getting my medicine, and I have to take the bus to go to the doctors." And I said, "Hey, Mom, why don't you kind of shake that stuff in California and come back to Texas, and Sally and I'll put you close by with us, and the family can love and hug you." And she said, "I'd like to think about that." When I put the phone down, I thought, "My God, Albert, did you really say that?" You know, and of course I did. Somewhere in there, somewhere within the magic and the chemistry of this thing, I'm an only child, and God says, "Hey, why don't you be a son that you're supposed to be?" And so my little mother came back, and it's been a real learning experience. Mother first got back, and the first thing we did, you know, once a week, I try to take her to lunch and to the grocery store. And so she loves that. She walks a cane, but she loves those grocery carts because it's just like a walker. So we went to lunch, and I took her to Tom Thumb, and I took her for the first time, and I put her in the bread section. I explained how the bread's here, and the fresh fruits are down there. You just kind of work your way through. And so I put her in the bread section. I was gone for about 45 minutes, and I came back. I thought maybe she was down having a Coke. She was in the second aisle. So I thought, well, this is interesting. So I went down and had a Coke, and I just sat there for a while. 2 hours later, she showed up in fresh fruits and vegetables. So I picked her up and got the groceries, took her home, and once a week we go have pizza, loves pizza. We go have pizza, I take her to Tom Thumb, and I put her in the bread section. I say, "Okay, Mom, you go have a good time now." 2 hours later, I pick her up fresh fruits and vegetables. But when I take her home, and I carry the groceries in the house, and she says, "I can't tell you how much you mean to me." And I'm able to hold her for the first time. You know, it's a funny and peculiar thing. I could come in here, I don't even know you. I can hold you, I can embrace you, I can feel your affection, I can feel my affection for you, but I couldn't hold my mom. The thought of holding my mother and kind of embracing her, I just couldn't do it. My sponsor and I have talked a lot about that. But I want to tell you, for 2 years now, Sally and I have had to take her to the hospital 3 different times. We've had to call 911 3 different times. Once a week I take her and I hold her. Yesterday I took her to JCPenney so she could have a perm for 3 hours. And I found myself saying to her, "Hey, Mom, you understand, you have a perm, I have a perm. You take 3 hours out of my day." And I went, "Oh, Albert, come on. Don't say things like that, you dodo." So I'm learning at age 68 to be a son to my 89-year-old mom. That's an incredible gift you have given me, that God has given me. That I can be a husband to my wife, I can be a father to my children, I can be a son to my mother. I was none of those things when I got here. My sponsor, I'm sorry to run over, my sponsor who I had for 20 years in Dallas, a couple of years ago got sick, physically and mentally, at 32 years in the program. So Sally and I had been out for dinner with Shep and Nancy on a Friday night, and Shep was there, and I'm sitting here, and Shep turned to me and he said, "Albert, I really need you." A phrase you hear quite frequently in this program. And I said to Sally, "You know, come Monday, I need to have lunch and take Shep to a meeting." And I got busy. And Tuesday morning, Sally called me at my office, and she said, "Hey, Albert, I hate to tell you, but Shep's dead." I said, "Wow." She said, "More than that, he shot himself." I said, "Oh, God." Now you have to understand, Shep was a sparkle-eyed little Irishman, greatest sponsor. And he was a great storyteller. He's one of these little Irish guys that would tell you stories that had a moral to the story. And I'm going to tell you the last story that Shep told me. Shep was a member of the Flying Tigers. He was one of Chennault's Flying Tigers. He was a fighter pilot. He said, "Albert, I was going down this road." He said, "Off in the distance, I saw this fighter plane." He said, "The kind that I used to fly." He said, "My curiosity got the best of me." And he said, I drove over to take a look at that fighter plane. And he said, "It so happened that the guy that owned the plane was there." And the two of us began to talk and telling war stories. And the old guy said to Shep, "Shep, how'd you like to take that fighter plane up?" Shep said, "Oh, God, it's been too long. I wouldn't dare." The guy said, "That's all right." He said, "Hey, I'll go up with you." He said, the two of them got in the plane. They got airborne. They're flying around. The old guy said to Shep, he said, "Shep, how'd you like to fly this thing, Shep?" "Oh, God," he said, "I wouldn't dare. It's been way too long." The guy said, "That's all right. I'm here with you." He said, "Albert, I got a hold of that stick." He said, "I got so excited." He said, "I pulled that stick back." He said, "That nose went straight up." And he said, "I almost stalled that plane out." He said, "I got so excited." He said, "I took that stick and I pushed it forward." He said, "The nose of that plane went over." He said, "We started going to the ground." He said, "I almost put it in the ground." He said, "That old guy took the stick away from me." He said, "We got down on the ground." He said, "The old guy came over to me, Albert, and he said, 'You know, Shep, you forgot that flying an airplane and keeping the wings level is not one big pull or one big push. It's just one minor adjustment after another.' He said, 'You know, Albert, your program is a lot like that. It ain't one big push. It ain't one big pull. It's just one minor adjustment after another.'" I don't have an ending for this other than the fact that Sally and I are just delighted to be back with you. We love you much. You have an outstanding lineup of speakers. I see Frank over there. And I know Bo and Shirley and Sissy. And you should just have a magnificent weekend. Love you for the invitation. Thanks much. Goodbye.